of the Bristol Poverty Institute at the University of Bristol. Mohan, welcome. Let me first.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me first start with Professor Gordon. Many thanks, Professor Gordon, for joining us. First up, recent images on social media that I'm sure you've seen in the news, and that's the school emergency lunches. Many saying they're falling short of the standards that are expected. The complaints are that they cannot feed two children on the portions that are given. Why is the government then allowing standards to slip, and what are they doing to rectify the situation?
Well, Kaveh, that, of course, is a really important question, and thank you for inviting me on your show in order to discuss these issues. There, of course, is a major problem of an increase in inequality and of poverty in the UK and around the world because of the pandemic. So what we've found is that over the past year, about a third of households have reported a fall in income. And the Food Foundation did a survey in the summer which found that something like 5 million adults were now food insecure, which is more than double what it had been previously. And over the summer, when children were not in school because of the summer holidays, something like 11% of children reported that their families had to rely on food banks in order to supplement the amount of food they had. So there's a real problem because of the pandemic. And it's led to quite a significant increase in the number of the children and families that are food insecure, something that we haven't seen for 50 or 60 years at this kind of scale.
Thank you for that, Professor. Well, Mohan, you know, some truly worrying times for the children of Britain. I'm going to skip what I have written down here, and because you made a comment that not a whole lot has really changed from 20, 25 years ago. Maybe the depth of the problem is a little bit more now. Can you elaborate on that a little bit and put it into perspective for us?
Sure, but I mean, food poverty has been a long-standing issue in the UK. I mean, some people trace it back to the late 1970s, the transition from, you know, kind of quasi-socialist regimes of the Labour Party to Margaret Thatcher, who brought in kind of extreme conservatism and so-called the Thatcherite brand of economics. So it's a long-standing issue. And I think it's one that successive governments clearly have not been able to get on top of. And by all credible accounts, it's got worse recently.
Okay, very well. Yeah. We're going to continue on that trend after a little bit as it goes by here. Now, we're going to take a look now at this next report. This next report studies why so many famous faces in the UK are lobbying the government to take action against child hunger and also poverty.
It was not just the parents of children who took to the likes of social media to complain about the shocking food packages that were being made available to British children stuck in poverty. A host of famous faces took the problem on and used their positions and influence to drill home the message to the government that current measures being taken were simply not enough. One of the most prominent campaigners against the treatment of children in poverty in the UK is Manchester United and England footballer Marcus Rashford, who is a young man experienced and lived through the tough times firsthand that are still being seen across the UK today, as explained by Marcus Rashford's very own mother in a recent interview.
I had three jobs and if I didn't do that, we just wouldn't have been able to cook a pot of food. It's just a bit difficult. So Marcus is only telling the story from how he sees it from, and the words that he's been saying, they obviously come from the bottom of his heart.
Such was the impact of Marcus Rashford on child food poverty in Britain that Boris Johnson and his ultra-elite rich boy cabinet was forced to listen and overturn the draconian measures, earning Marcus Rashford recognition from the Queen in his work in fighting child poverty. It's also seen many others take inspiration from the footballer, and all have contributed in their own way.
This campaign by Marcus Rashford, who is an absolute legend for what he's doing, he's stuck to his roots. This is our inspiration. I think this is most of the cafes, restaurants around the country are doing it because of him. We have to feed our children.
But in spite of the many famous faces doing their bit to tackle food poverty in Britain, the problem does not just lie with food, as poverty in the UK is much wider and deeper than meets the eye, and is a problem that, according to one volunteer, sees the blame lying solely at the feet of the British government. who have allowed cuts, austerity, and mismanagement to bring the people of Britain to their knees as they beg their way out of poverty.
It's not an easy thing to tackle, and it's not just food poverty, it's poverty as a whole. So we're coming back from years and years of austerity. Funding has been cut for so many different services. It's about reinvesting in the community.
Joining me back in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Professor David Gordon from the University of Bristol. Okay, Mahan, welcome back.
Welcome.
Let me go to the professor first. Professor, some famous faces have stepped in to talk about this very important issue of child poverty. You have the likes of people like Marcus Rashford, you have Tom Kerish. Why should it take such famous celebrities to finally come about and raise awareness and finally kickstart some form of action to be taken in tackling this very important issue?
Well, academics have been warning NGOs have been warning about this problem for some time. It's although the pandemic has brought it into sharp focus, it's been a growing problem for 10 years or more. The government has been pursuing policies of austerity, and they've been squeezing benefits for those of working age, particularly families with children. And in particular, there have been some rather punitive changes to the welfare budget, particularly for families who are reliant on welfare benefits, who have more than two children or who have extra rooms in their household. The government has really squeezed their incomes. Now, during the pandemic, they've raised those welfare benefits for some families, but again, these kinds of ideological squeezes on the incomes of some of the poorest in society are still in place, and it's taken celebrities to complain in order for the government to suddenly wake up to these problems. They've just ignored all the NGOs and academics and been able to do that because Brexit so dominated the political debate. But the pandemic, reality is hit because of the pandemic, and there is a genuine and real dire problem in one of the richest countries in the world. There should not be a problem of feeding children. It's something that you might expect in sub-Saharan Africa or parts of Asia, but in the UK, it's a scandal.
Okay, thank you for that, Professor. Mahan, let's turn our focus to Marcus Rashford becoming a thorn in the side of the Tory government, it seems, as his campaigns have led to numerous U-turns by Boris Johnson, for example, and earned him an MBE in the process. Why does Marcus Rashford, or anyone for that matter, actually keep defeating public policies that are set by the Conservatives, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure he's actually defeated a public policy, because the policy is still in place. The policy is to, quite literally, to starve people who can't afford it. Because as the professor rightly said, the UK has all the resources it needs to feed everybody in the country. But for ideological, political, and I would actually say cultural reasons, they're choosing not to do that. So they would prefer for kids to literally starve than to provide this universally. Now, Marcus Rashford, of course, he's a celebrity, so he's highlighted this issue. But I suspect that this is going to be a transitory thing. Somebody else may occupy his place. The real issue here is just the whole privatization of everything, including the provision of school meals for children. Now, not just a few weeks ago, a private company was actually paid £35 per school meal. Okay, so they were given this tranche of money by the government, and out of that £35, they actually spent £5 on the school meals, and they pocketed the balance. So the result was these grubby meals. Whereas for £35, you could provide a lavish meal.
What were the grubby meals? What were they provide? You know?
Well, just I mean, the pictures are on the internet. People can just Google it. You know, rusty bread, a potato, a piece of carrot, for instance. And so they'd been given the budget to provide, but they chosen not to do so. So privatization is a big issue, mm-hmm. And of course the macro stuff that the professor alluded to, Brexit being a huge preoccupation.
Sure.
So I suspect this issue is actually going to get much worse, and the historical trajectory supports that argument, because the UK has been on this trajectory now for 40 plus years. I don't expect to see them come off the ramps just yet.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate both Mahan and Professor Gordon there. Now we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Tapway. Time now to take a deeper look at the UK child food crisis in Britain in our in-depth section. One of the most disturbing stories to emerge, particularly for the British government, is the action being taken by UNICEF, who, for the first time, has had to step in and feed Britain's children. For the first time in 70 years, the UN agency will help fund food parcels, helping to supply at least 18,000 meals to children across Britain. Now, the political ramifications of UNICEF stepping in is a huge embarrassment to the Conservative government, with Deputy Labour leader Angela Rayner actually stating that the fact UNICEF is having to step in to feed the country is a disgrace to Boris Johnson and Chancellor Rishi Sunak, who should be ashamed, indeed something that has left them red-faced. But it seems that the UK government is splitting the inequality gap wider than ever, as it simply refuses to tax the super-rich into paying to reduce the poverty levels in Britain, with the likes of Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, all multimillionaires. Seems that the class system in Britain is designed to solely favor the elite. Yet with food packages still arriving unfit for purpose, it seems that the children of Britain living below the poverty line are stuck with food packages as seen on your screens and as you see over here, with two children designed to being fed for 1 week. Well, this raises the question as to just how parents are expected to manage as things go from bad to worse. Well, time now to take a look at our final report today, which examines just what the British government is doing to solve the problem.
It's amazing to think that the current government of the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, won an election giving him an 80-seat majority in Parliament. The main surge in support for Johnson came from the voters in the so-called Red Wall area, who were once traditional Labour voters from a working-class background and lived in one of the poorest deciles of poverty in Britain, lulled into voting for the Tories under the false pretext of getting Brexit done. Yet now that Johnson has his feet firmly and securely under the table of the desk at Downing Street, when the poorest people in Britain needed their leader the most, he soon forgot who put him in his place and just how he got there. As a quarter of the British population fall into poverty, with nearly 5 million of those being classified as living in extreme poverty, what then has the government of Boris Johnson done to alleviate the problem? The short answer is not enough. Many people in Britain who are now considered to be in poverty were not in this position prior to Brexit or the COVID-19 pandemic, yet the schemes designed by the government to save businesses and jobs appears to have fallen short of the goal, as furlough schemes and food packages have all shown to be failures as budgets limit the positive impact on dealing with the issue. It's hence why so many people in Britain have turned to non-governmental sources of assistance and sees Britain relying on the charity of local groups and individuals to see them through the dark tunnel of poverty, in particular when it comes to school children stuck at home with no food to eat.
So here we are now back feeding. Today's almost 50, but we've got another school talking to me this afternoon. I think they're on about another 30 odd children coming on board from tomorrow.
Even charities and goodwill organisations, such as the one being run by Richmond Rugby Club, are baffled at how the government is failing to act, stating that they could not just sit back and let children go hungry.
Yeah, the politics, that's for the politicians, obviously. We don't want to politicise it, but we've just reacted to something we were doing in the summer. And the thought of kids going hungry over this week and maybe over Christmas as well. Yeah, we can't sit here and do nothing.
With the likes of Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Rishi Sunak all well into the multi-millionaires club, it seems that the economic divide between the rich and poor in Britain is doomed to grow ever wider and deeper, until of course the day comes when votes are required and suddenly the Tories may just find themselves again knocking on the doors of the poor, making promises that they're just unable to keep.
Back in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Professor David Gordon from the University of Bristol. Mahan, welcome back.
Welcome.
Professor, last question. Measures that are being taken by the UK government and UK-based charities, to resolve child hunger? Please tell us. I mean, can you give any examples of what is being done to improve poverty conditions, particularly when it comes to children?
Well, the government has invested because of the pandemic, so it's introduced a furlough scheme, so most of the people who would like to have become unemployed have not done so, although of course there are gaps in this safety net, and unemployment has more than doubled, although it's still at a much lower rate than it would have been, and they have increased the benefits. Of course, charities have stepped up, and religious organisations, and there's now been mass rollouts of food banks and collections for people who are having food insecure to go and get food so they can feed themselves and their children. But we have seen an increase in destitution. We have seen an increase in children going to bed hungry, things which never used to exist 20 years ago and shouldn't exist today. It is an embarrassment. There should be no child going to bed hungry in the UK. There should be no family dependent on food banks. And this has to change.
Well, David Gordon, thank you so much. Professor of Social Justice and Director of the Bristol Poverty Institute at the University
of
Bristol.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
The Western Show.
Well, Mohan, we heard the professor there. And, of course, I'd like to find out from you now in the final question. The current government, British government, is made up of an Oxbridge of millionaires-only club. How on earth can they claim that they can feel the pain some of these children are going through in terms of the food poverty that they're experiencing, and then come out and say that we're trying to help them?
Well, the government being made up of elites, again, that's not a new thing in the UK. It's a long-standing cultural thing. And it's just the tip of the iceberg. Look, I fully concur with your guess. This shouldn't be happening. But I fear it will go on happening because, as I stated before, it's not just a political issue. There's ideology here, and there's also culture. So I don't envisage the UK getting on top of this problem. They have all the resources to do it, but they won't, because you know there's a long-standing, deep belief that their state simply shouldn't be doing this.
All right, thank you so much. We appreciate that. Mohan, it's good to see you again. Mohan Abedin in the studios with us. Also, thanks Professor Gordon from the University of Bristol again for his input into the program. Food poverty in the UK is a bitter pill to swallow for the authorities. On the one hand, many children are going to bed with empty stomachs, wondering where their next meal is going to come from, while those are being given some form of aid are left disappointed by inadequate portions and unbalanced diets. For those in the lowest deciles of poverty who do eat, 12% of 4 to 5-year-olds are obese, not from overeating, but from eating processed and fatty foods, many of which are the cheapest and most readily available on the supermarket shelves. With pressure now mounting on the government to resolve the situation, food insecurity in Britain comes with a huge human cost, price that the current generations in the UK will likely carry with them for the rest of their lives, affecting their health, their well-being, and their futures. Don't forget, we want to hear your thoughts on this or any other topic, so do write in and let us know what you think. But for now, that's about all the time we have on this week's show. So on behalf of myself, Kavit Tafoyi, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I
Faisal Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa afdalu salawati wa tamu taslim ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin. My name is Sheikh Zayd al-Salami. I just wanted to follow up on something that I mentioned in the previous episode about the emphasis on oral hygiene. And I mentioned that there are so many adab, mustahabat, to do with one's mouth and things related to it. Now, probably, you know, on a scientific level, a person might say, well, you know, it's also going to, with the istinshaq and the madmada, you know, istinshaq is when you sniff water, and madmada is when you gargle water. That's all good for your, for example, sinus. It's good for your teeth, your gum, all of these, lip, your tongue, all of these other things that are related to oral hygiene. The point that I wanted to make was that I think that a very important issue is that we naturally, as human beings, we communicate with people verbally. So we talk with people. And, you know, the worst thing for us to have is bad breath. And so that emphasis on oral hygiene, one way of looking at it, which itself is a very important aspect because of, you know, us frequently socializing with other people and things like that, is, you know, that we want to make sure that we have good breath, that our breath doesn't smell that bad when we're communicating with people. And I do believe that, you know, in everything that we're talking about as far as general hygiene is concerned, and all comes down to how much Islam encourages us to take care of ourselves, you know. And I think that's something unique in Islam, that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, who was at the peak of spiritual enlightenment and who represented Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this earth, and who was the most humble and most ascetic person, but at the same time he took care of himself, the way he dressed, the way he appeared in public, the way he appeared to his family, for his family. And, you know, if someone wants to choose a spiritual life, that doesn't mean that, you know, they have to go off towards, you know, becoming, in that particular sense, you know, choosing a monastic life and abandoning everything and relinquishing all means and not taking care of yourself and allowing yourself to become a scruffy person and not brush your hair and not brush your teeth and not clean yourself and all these other things. Absolutely not. Islam says the way for you to reach spiritual highness is through all of these things. So you can get to that lofty spiritual level by doing these things. And of course, we did mention in the previous episode that this all comes within that whole natural instinct of who we are as human beings, you know. And that's why Islam does not shun away from our relationships, getting married. And hygiene does play a very important role in this as well, because you want to be presentable not only to people in the public, you know, but also to your spouse.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amiri, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه. چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرون دماغ قصاب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درختکاری رو کم ثواب داره. دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که رو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
You want to be clean, you want to make sure that, you know, when you do enter the house or when you are alone that, you know, the other person is not, you know, suffering because of you having a bad stench or you not taking care of yourself and in your appearance as far as your hair, as far as everything else is concerned. I'm going to mention some of the adab of combing and brushing, which in itself is, you know, astonishing than the amount of what it is that Islam says about that. But, you know, carrying on with this point about oral hygiene and making sure that we take care of our mouths, and it doesn't need to be glittering white and we don't need to get porcelain teeth and all these other things, but at least, you know, we are making sure that we take care of our mouths. And I just wanted to mention in a few pages after where we're up to, there's a hadith mentioned where Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi ruwiya annahu sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, it has been narrated that the Holy Prophet, praise and peace be upon him, kana la yanamu illa wassiwaku inda ra'sih, that he would never sleep without having his siwak right next to him. فَإِذَا نَهَضَ بَدَأَ بِالسِّوَاكِ, and when he wakes up, the first thing that he does is he uses his siwak to clean his teeth, to brush his teeth. You know, and that's, again, you know, it wasn't just where it is that we mentioned about siwak. There's ongoing kind of mentioning about this sunnah of Islam, and it is a sunnah of Islam. When we look at these things, we can see that they are the unique elements of, you know, hygiene, Islamic hygiene, if we could call that. And this is all, again, to do with al-tibb al-Islami as well, with Islamic medicine. So I would like to just draw attention to my dear brothers and sisters that should you wish to delve deeper into this area, you're also going to, you know, be confronted with what Islamic medicine has to say about all of this. We'll continue on with these topics in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, bahre ehyaye haq jan fada, Kas batre, batre ye khun paak shoma, Mi
in the limelight.
Due to their skill and provocative nature, the annual U.S. South Korea combined exercises have long been a trigger point for heightened military and political tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Anne Wright, former U.S. diplomat. This article is published under the heading, For Peace with North Korea, Biden Must End the U.S.-South Korea Military Exercises. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. One of the thorniest foreign policy challenges the Biden administration will need to face is a nuclear-armed North Korea. Talks between the U.S. and North Korea have been stalled since 2019, and North Korea has continued to develop its weapons arsenal, recently unveiling what appears to be its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. Actions by the U.S. military can exacerbate tensions that lead to war. That's why the U.S. and South Korea must end combined U.S.-South Korea military exercises. Due to their skill and provocative nature, the annual U.S.-South Korea combined exercises have long been a trigger point for heightened military and political tensions on the Korean Peninsula. These military exercises have been suspended since 2018, but General Robert B. Abrams, commander of U.S. Forces Korea, has renewed the call for the full resumption of the joint war drills. U.S. and South Korean defense ministers have also agreed to continue the combined exercises, and Biden's Secretary of State nominee, Antony Blinken, has said suspending them was a mistake. Rather than acknowledge how these joint military exercises have proven to raise tensions and provoke actions by North Korea, Blinken has criticized the suspension of the exercises as an appeasement of North Korea. And despite the failure of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against North Korea, not to mention decades of U.S. pressure-based tactics, Blinken insists more pressure is what's needed to achieve North Korea's denuclearization. In a CBS interview, Blinken said the U.S. should build genuine economic pressure to squeeze North Korea to get it to the negotiating table. Unfortunately, if the Biden administration chooses to go through with the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises in March, it will likely sabotage any prospect of diplomacy with North Korea in the near future, heighten geopolitical tensions, and risk reigniting a war on the Korean Peninsula, which would be catastrophic. Since 1950s, the U.S. has used the military exercises as a show of force to deter a North Korean attack on South Korea. To North Korea, however, these military exercises, with names such as Exercise Decapitation, appear to be rehearsal for the overthrow of its government. Consider that these U.S.-South Korea combined military exercises have involved the use of B-2 bombers capable of dropping nuclear weapons, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, and submarines equipped with nuclear weapons, as well as the firing of long-range artillery and other large-caliber weapons. Thus, suspending the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises would be a much-needed confidence-building measure and could help restart talks with North Korea at a time when the world is facing urgent humanitarian, environmental, and economic crises. The U.S.-South Korea military exercises also divert critically needed resources away from efforts to provide true human security through the provision of health care and the protection of the environment. These joint exercises cost U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars and have caused irreparable injury to local residents and damage to the environment in South Korea. On all sides, the ongoing tensions on the Korean Peninsula have been used to justify massive military spending. North Korea ranks first in the world in military spending as a percentage of its GDP. But in total dollars, South Korea and the United States spend vastly more on defense, with the U.S. ranking first in military spending worldwide. That is about $732 billion, more than the next 10 countries combined. And South Korea ranking 10th, that is about $43.9 billion. By comparison, North Korea's entire budget is just $8.47 billion as of 2019, according to the Bank of Korea. Ultimately, to stop this dangerous, expensive arms race and remove the risk of renewed war, the Biden administration should immediately reduce tensions with North Korea by working to resolve the root cause of the conflict, the long-standing 70-year-old Korean War. Ending this war is the only way to achieve permanent peace and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, other life forms, if there are any pets or plants in the room, hello little kitty, in the room which this show is being listened to, greetings. You never know if our listener could have a cat or a pretty little plant in the corner somewhere. So I'm sending my peace and salutations upon that cat and plant. I feel like it's the right thing to do, you know?
Yay.
As a Muslim, we have to express peace toward all life forms.
Exactly.
Yes, cats, plants, humans.
Especially cats.
Especially cats.
Because you like them.
Specifically cats. Yeah. Cats are good. Cats are so important.
Yeah.
Speaking of cats.
Until they scratch you.
I'm glad you brought that up. Because cats are the only living creatures. Like, cats are the literal definition of biting the hand that feeds you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have had a cat or not, but every time I go in to pet my cat, first she lets me, like, scratch behind her ears, under her neck, her belly. She shows her belly, and then suddenly she goes, and
so
attacks
you
me.
Cats are toxic?
It's true, though. Every cat owner knows.
Okay, so it's sad, but it's true.
It's sad, but it's true.
Yeah.
You know? True story. So today's topic, as you might have realized, is toxic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the border? You know, what's the limit to? Where do you draw the line for a toxic person in your life?
So there are different levels of toxicity.
Yes.
So first, how do you define, you know?
Very good question.
Yeah, toxic. Rather, was a toxic people.
Toxic people, I think, are those...
You feel uncomfortable being around them?
Yes. But for a reason. You know, sometimes I feel uncomfortable being around someone because I'm socially awkward. Well, it's not that person's fault.
Like
that
introvert.
I'm an introvert and I don't like being around people and it's nobody's fault. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything wrong with me. I just don't enjoy the company of others.
Yeah.
But there are people who I would define as toxic are those who drain too much of your energy.
Mm-hmm. Like in what way?
They give you negative vibes.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So this toxic could be a lot of things. Toxic could be because they're narcissists.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole mental problem.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
yeah.
We're not even going to get there. Toxic could be someone who's just negative all the time.
So their negativity, it slows down you like achieving goals.
Yes, your productivity.
It slows it down, yeah.
Exactly. It slows down your progress because it drains your energy so much.
And they add stress.
And they add stress to your life. Well, who needs that? You know, life is so stressful and draining enough as it is.
Yeah.
We're supposed to surround ourselves with people who encourage, inspire, empower, educate, and educate us and help us grow.
Yeah.
If that person is going to be draining my energy, the energy that I already have so little left, you know, because life is hard, and I need to invest that energy in becoming a better person and reaching Allah, that person is bringing my energy down because they're negative, because they only see the half empty of the glass, because they complain about everything and everyone. Oh my God, I'm doing it right now. I'm complaining, but toxic people complain about everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes a situation could be positive.
They just don't like whatsoever we do.
Yeah. Or they're all constantly complaining about their own lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes a situation, there's always going to be pros and cons to a situation.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be ups and downs. A situation will have good parts in it and bad parts.
Mm-hmm.
A toxic person, I feel, is someone who focuses only on those bad parts and then projects it onto other people.
So do you think that, you know, being toxic, you know, it's harmful for themselves as well as the other?
Oh, yes.
As well as the people around
100%.
Them?
100%. Being toxic is just as harmful as being around someone toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been around anyone toxic?
Yeah, sometimes. No, it's just like,
how
you know,
the experience?
Why is this guy over here? Because sometimes we feel like that. Oh,
why do you think they were toxic? What did they do that made them toxic?
You know, it's like sometimes they just don't like the stuff we do. Like, even though we are completely right, they just don't like it. They oppose it.
You know, they pick on you.
Yeah, I don't know what's the reason. You know, sometimes I don't like, it's toxicity because of, you know, are they jealous or
definitely
personal grudges? Mm. What's the reason behind the toxicity?
Yeah, I think the reason is usually jealousy.
Envy.
Yes, exactly. They can't stand to see anyone else mm-hmm. better than them. And, you know, being successful and achieving more. They just can't stand
That's so bad, man.
It is bad. Yeah. Because not only is it hurting the other person,
uh-huh.
but it's preventing you from growth, too.
Yeah.
I think there's a hadith from Amir al-Mumin Ali alayhi salam that says, I'm paraphrasing, of course,
mm-hmm.
as always, we need to remind ourselves that Amir al-Mu'mineen is much, 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 much more eloquent and wise. He says in a very sarcastic way, you know, mm-hmm. explaining how jealousy is such a good
mm-hmm.
quality.
It's a good quality?
Because
uh-huh.
it damages the possessor of jealousy more than the person who they're jealous toward.
Yeah.
Right? So if I'm a jealous person, I'm the one who's going to get hurt by uh-huh. this quality of jealousy uh-huh. more than Brother Hassanain, whom I'm jealous toward.
Uh-huh.
Right? So it's yeah. like jealousy is very...
So it's causing an impact on you, yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Definitely, jealous people are toxic. Even if they don't express their jealousy directly,
mm-hmm.
the vibe, you know, the negative energy they yeah. send toward you is just bad.
Yeah. So, you know what I feel about, you know, toxic people? I feel like they're just a burden for us. You know, how do I define toxic people?
You
know,
how?
You
Tell
know,
me.
There are some... I don't know if it's... you might find it awkward, but... Mm. I think toxic people are like, you know, lumps on our body. You know, they're just, you know, of no use.
Mm.
But there are lumps which are of no use as well as they hurt you.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, there's just a lump that's of no use. This is somewhere around the corner of your mm. body. But there are lumps which is of no use and also it's causing you pain.
Causes you pain, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So, toxic people are like that. So what I say is just... We need to just get rid of it from, you know.
But there's this thing, see, the case with toxic people really depends on who that person is. We are speaking as if that toxic person is your neighbor, your colleague, mm-hmm. some random stranger on the bus.
Some people that we cannot avoid.
Exactly. Sometimes the toxic,
like, toxic people
are our siblings, our immediate family members, our colleagues, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
I can't necessarily avoid this person, I'll lose my job.
It might be your roommate.
Yeah, I can't avoid this person. What am I supposed to do? Move out? Stop talking to him? It doesn't work that way. So, like when you said, it depends on where that lump is.
Yeah.
You know, if that lump is on your brain,
mm-hmm.
you are going to try to live with it.
Yeah.
Because if they crack up your skull and try to remove that lump, there might be the risk of brain damage.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So you're better off trying to live with it, trying mm-hmm. to navigate your way around it. And it's just hard. Sometimes some toxic relationships are inevitable, unavoidable, and plain, mm-hmm. hardcore hard.
Mm-hmm.
I suggest counseling, therapy.
Yeah, of course. As said in the earlier programs, that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has said that when God has created a disease,
mm-hmm.
He has surely created a treatment for it. So there's definitely a treatment for, you know, toxic people and the toxicity. So what can it be?
Well, I think like every other ailment, you can't treat it unless you acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal with toxic people is they seldom realize they're toxic.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Unless it's someone yeah. you really, really love, unless it's a best friend
mm-hmm.
or, like, it doesn't normally work with parents, but unless it's a best friend, a spouse, a sibling, or something like that,
mm-hmm.
they have to accept the fact that what they're doing is hurting the person they love
yeah.
before they can change it. You know?
How?
Change it, whether to trying to change their behavior. If there are, like, someone who complains a lot, I don't mm-hmm. think you need therapy. You know, you can work on yourself every day, bit by bit. Write down the things you're grateful for. Focus on the bright side of things. Or even if you feel like you want to complain, even if a situation is so horrible, there's no bright side to it, and you want to complain, just stay quiet.
Yeah.
And practice that for a while until it becomes a trait for you, and that toxic quality is removed.
Yeah.
But in harder cases, I definitely recommend therapy, like family counseling.
What about, like, just going and, you know, talking to him? Like,
yeah, that's the first stage. That's the first stage. You.
It might be a friend that you can just go and talk to him.
Yeah.
Like, bro, just stop it. I don't like it anymore.
That's the first stage, that you, as your friend, you go and you talk to your toxic friend.
But the second stage is who is the toxic person?
It depends on how much you care
like
for each other.
If it's your boss and you just go and talk to him, like...
Yeah, there's no point. Don't do that. Please don't do that.
Yeah.
There's no point. Exactly.
He'll fire you.
You just have to deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I said it depends on where, which body part that lump is.
Exactly.
If your lump is, you know, on your arm... on your finger, on your pinky. You can live without a pinky. That's fine. So basically, to wrap up on the topic of toxic people, we'd have to categorize it. The level of the toxicity and who that toxic person is. Right?
Yeah.
If it's someone who is an immediate family member, if it's our parents, our spouse, our... you know, best friend.
I guess that's the worst case.
That is
the worst case. When toxic people are in your family.
Exactly. In your family, it's definitely the worst. Because you can't cut ties with them.
It's the hardest lump to get rid of.
Exactly. And you can't be around them either.
Yeah.
So you have to try to maintain that distance and just ask God and professionals for help. You know?
Sabr will help you.
Yeah, exactly. Be patient and just power through. And Allah will reward you. And what's more important is try not to be that toxic person. I cannot emphasize on this enough. Please don't be toxic, you guys. And it could be the little things, you know, that we don't notice. You could be...
You know, some people might be toxic for us, and we might also be toxic for some others.
Exactly. So every time I feel that you are around a toxic person, try to reflect on yourself and see whether you have those traits in you or not. Because you never know. That's all the time we have.
So thank you so much to your listeners.
Thank you very much for being with us on this episode of Youth Station. Until the next time, we leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.